The principal concern of bad revisionist history, however, is not the past, but the present. By reading present concerns into the past, bad revisionism shirks the responsibility imposed by the six C's of historical thinking.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff, speaking at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Whenever one encounters what may seem a compelling historical narrative, he or she must ask, is the narrator sensitive to the realities of change over time, of continuity, of context, of causality, of the contingency of human events, and finally of the staggering complexity of the past? If so, then the historical narrative is likely reliable.
You can listen to Dr. Kaltoff's presentation, Making the Case Against Revisionist History, on a recording of this year's Making the Case conferences. We'll send it to you for a year-end tax-deductible gift of $300. Place your order at issuesetc.org.
You go into your high school government class and you give your opinion defending marriage is between a man and a woman, the class is not going to look at you and say, how brave. Your classmates are going to look at you and say, how intolerant.
They're opposed to femininity, but they're also opposed to masculinity. The worst being in the world is a man. The best being in the world is a male individual who is feminized.
Because on the other side of death for the Christian is not condemnation, is not judgment, but is Jesus who welcomes us and blesses us.
Northern Illinois Chainsaw Drivers, love, issues, etc.
There is a piece in The Atlantic titled The True Origins of ISIS that seeks to correct the record, to extend the conventional wisdom about the origins of the Islamic State back, well, another lifetime in a lot of ways. It says, well, the conventional wisdom is that it all began with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a name that is very familiar to those who watch things Islamic around the world. The Atlantic piece says, no, you've got to go back farther than that, than Zarqawi. He was not the origin. The origin actually came with another man who was involved with Zarqawi, but much earlier than that, the radicalization of Islam that would become the Islamic State. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio on this Monday, December the 3rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about that Atlantic piece titled The True Origins of ISIS. Robert Spencer of Jihad Watch will be our guest. A little bit later, Craig Evans joins us to talk about the discovery of a ring inscribed with the name Pilate. It can be only one person, and we'll find out how big of a discovery this is. There are many people who said Pontius Pilate was a fiction, although he appears prominently in the Gospels surrounding the last hours of Jesus before his crucifixion and his resurrection. Archaeologists doubted his existence, but there's more evidence piling up that he really did live. And then Pastor Peter Bender joins us. We'll be doing our series Lutheran Catechesis in the Fifth Commandment and the Murder of Abel. Feel free to join us with questions or comments or call in number 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about a column in The Atlantic on the true origins of ISIS, Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch and author of several books on Islam, including his latest, The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
Well, the basic thesis of The Atlantic piece is that the conventional wisdom about the origins of ISIS is not exactly right. It's got the right kind of line, but it doesn't go far enough back. Instead of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, it is, in fact, a man who would eventually become his right-hand man, Abu Ali an-Arbari, and it tells the story of how he was radicalized toward the direction of ISIS long before his eventual leader. What did you make of The Atlantic piece?
I thought The Atlantic piece was right on the money and that the conventional wisdom was always wrong. And as a matter of fact, I illustrate that in the history of jihad. The fact is that as the Atlantic piece points out, most people assume that ISIS arose after the Americans invaded Iraq and that it was a reaction to the invasion. whereas in reality, it grew out of Al-Qaeda, which is a group that was founded in the 1990s. And as the article shows, Arbari was a Muslim cleric who was very deeply knowledgeable in the Islamic theology of the caliphate, and he wanted to restore the caliphate and thought that Iraq was a good place for that to happen. And as I show in the book, the caliphate was the guiding force of jihad violence for centuries, and in Islamic theology, in Sunni Islamic theology, is considered to be the only entity that is authorized to declare jihad. And so the restoration of the caliphate has always been, since it was abolished in 1924, job one of the various jihad groups around the world. And so ISIS arose out of that desire, and had the American invasion of Iraq was only tangential to its creation.
Why is this narrative so attractive, whether it is the origins of ISIS, well, we caused it by invading Iraq, that's essentially the narrative there, or it has its various other forms, we caused this, we caused that, even down to individual terrorist attacks, either here or abroad, by doing this or doing that. Why is that narrative so attractive to Westerners?
Well, there is a dogmatic connection, attachment, I should say, in Washington and among media analysts all over, to the idea that Islam is a religion of peace, and that any violence done in its name is done by a tiny minority of extremists who have twisted and hijacked its peaceful teachings. And consequently, every occasion of violence in the name of Islam has to be explained by other means and not by reference to Islamic teachings. And so the idea that ISIS arose because of American actions in Iraq is in line with this dogmatic attachment to this idea that Islam is a religion of peace. It's fictional, of course, and it's completely ahistorical, as I show in the history of jihad. But I also think actually the worst thing about it, Todd, is that it's paternalistic and ethnocentric. It's funny how the proponents of tolerance and multiculturalism and diversity are the ones who say this, because what they're actually saying is that Muslims are only able to react to what America does and what other people do, what Israel does. There's never any possibility they might do things for reasons of their own. We are the only ones with that power. And so it's an unconscious kind of paternalism and ethnocentrism that is driving this false notion.
If there were an event in the 1400 years from Muhammad to the Islamic State that you think the average person needs to know to begin to understand the much, much longer history of jihad and of the desire for a caliphate that has existed in Islam, you say from the very beginning since Muhammad's death, what would that event be? What would you pick?
That's a very good question, Todd. There are several key events and key incidents, and I think that one important one that I would point out in view of all the historical revisionism and its false history that's out there is the reign of Akbar the Great, who was a Mughal emperor in India, a Muslim empire in India. This is actually not connected to the caliphate because the Mughals did not accept the Ottoman caliphate and were essentially a rival to it, although they never tried to venture outside India. In any case, the Mughal emperors were very ruthless and repressive to the Hindus in India. And this is because the Islamic theology is that the people of the book, that is the Jews and Christians, can be allowed to practice their religions as long as they pay the tax, the jizya, that's specified in the Quran, and remain subservient to the hegemony of the Muslims, accepting various humiliating and discriminatory regulations. But the Hindus were not people of the book. And so the Islamic rule in India was much bloodier and more draconian than it ever was in other areas. And then Akbar the Great in the 16th century was one of these emperors. He became disenchanted with Islam and ultimately left Islam altogether. And the more he began to dislike Islam, the kinder and gentler he became to his Hindu subjects. and relaxed the jizya tax and various other restrictions that they had to live under, and even explained to his son Jahangir, who succeeded him and was another Islamic hardliner, that he couldn't keep persecuting these people, that the one God had created all of them and all the Muslims as well, and why should he favor the one over the other? And this is the only time of tolerance and peace during Muslim rule in India, and it came not because of Islam, as historical myth would have it, that Islam brought tolerance and peace, and there was an era of multiculturalism in Muslim Spain and elsewhere, not because of Islam, but actually as a rejection of Islam. And that, I think, is kind of a hallmark of the record of 1,400 years of Islamic rule around the world. As for the caliphate, yes, it's considered to be the only legitimate succession from Muhammad. The word caliph is successor, and the caliph is the successor of Muhammad as the military, political, and spiritual leader of the Muslims worldwide. There were always caliphates, as I show in the book, all through Islamic history until 1924. And the abolition of the caliphate by the secular Turks is considered by the jihad groups today to be the source of all their troubles and the reason why the Islamic world is weak and disunited. So that's why they want to restore the caliphate, because they believe it will once again reunite the Muslims and strengthen them in jihad against non-Muslims.
Is that why the average Muslim, I'm thinking here of someone who is in a Muslim country, not the average rank and file, but perhaps someone who is in the leadership, the religious leadership, is that the explanation they would give for the rise of something like the Islamic State? Would they say because the caliphate was eliminated under a westernized Islamic rule?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that is the rhetoric that all the supporters of these kinds of groups give, that the Islamic world has been forcibly disunited by the colonial powers who destroyed the Ottoman Empire after World War I, the last caliphate. And it is they take advantage of this disunity to enforce the weakness of Islam and the Muslims, and that Islam as a world movement and as a political movement will only revive when the caliphate returns.
How do those who essentially blame the West or Israel, depending on the circumstances, for the behavior of Muslims in the world today, how do they explain the violence that has trailed through Muslim history from Muhammad on before the existence of the U.S. or the nation state of Israel?
Todd, they mostly ignore it and deny it and hope you don't know about it. It's a very strange thing, but the historical revisionism nowadays is rampant and universal. There's a professor, for example, at the American University in Washington, D.C. His name is Akbar Ahmed. He is very widely respected. He goes and speaks at all these venerable institutions, and he's welcomed. He's hailed by diplomats and presidents and prime ministers. And he just recently wrote a book that says that what Europe needs is a new Al-Andalus, that is, a new Muslim Spain, a new rule of the Muslims, because he argues that Muslim Spain in the Middle Ages was this paradise of multiculturalism. Well, I show from primary sources in the history of jihad that Spain was anything but a paradise of multiculturalism. It was a horrible place for Jews and Christians. They were persecuted, they were oppressed, they were discriminated against, and they were subjected to periodic violence. It was a center of the Islamic slave trade and worse. And so what Akbar Ahmed is doing is banking on our not knowing the true history of Islamic Spain and instead accepting the historical myths that have been propagated over the last 20 years about how it was some paradise.
If you travel to Spain, you're going to, and you tour some of the larger cities there, you're going to inevitably be shown on these tours the remnants of a Muslim occupation there, and you're going to be told that this was a great time of enlightenment and a great time of peace and tranquility when Muslims encroached upon that end of Europe. How would you correct that?
Well, I would correct it with the historical record. I have plenty of anecdotes in the book, for example, of the reign of the Umayyad Caliph of Cordoba, Abd al-Rahman, and how he would routinely terrorize the Christian population. He once took 100 Christians at random and had them beheaded in the public square with a large audience of other Christians watching as a warning. Also, there were riots against the Jews, a pogrom in 1066, where 4,000 Jews were murdered by Muslims because the Muslim ruler of Granada had put a Jew in charge of the city because they were personal friends. And, you know, people don't always observe the laws, but the laws of Islam are that a non-Muslim must not have authority over a Muslim. So the Muslims knew the law, and they rioted and killed 4,000 Jews. These are the realities of Islamic Spain. We have to just keep going back to the original sources and tell the truth to anyone who is willing to hear it.
You end the book with a quotation from the last Byzantine emperor, Constantine the 11th, and something that he is said to have said to his nobles on the eve of the fall of Constantinople. What did he say? What did that generation of those who faced the threat of Islam understand that we don't understand today?
Well, he said that it would be a good and noble thing to die for one's faith and for one's country, and that it was better to die in battle and against these people than to surrender and be subjugated by them. And he thanked them for their courage and their perseverance in holding out against this siege for so long. What we've forgotten in that is, in the first place, that there's anything worth defending in the West. We have a whole generation of young people now, and I see them when I speak on college campuses and university campuses, that they've grown up, they've been taught at these universities to despise and even hate Judeo-Christian Western civilization, the United States. I mean, these people are never going to defend our nation against enemies. They embrace the enemies, and they're taught to do so by their professors. They would be aghast at Constantine the 11th saying that it's a noble thing to die for Christ, and his implicit criticism of the Muslim invaders. They would say he was being Islamophobic and racist and bigoted, and probably said that he would say he should open his gates. They should have opened the gates of Constantinople to the invaders instead of holding out under siege. Nowadays, we've lost any sense of an idea that we have a heritage, a nation, a religious tradition, a cultural tradition, anything worth defending. And if we don't know that it's worth defending, we ain't going to defend it, and we'll lose it.
On the subject of the Crusades, it's an enormous subject, and it spans 1,000 years, but what is the biggest myth that you want to correct about that conflict between what we could say loosely is Christendom and Islam?
Yeah, most people, Bill Clinton and among them, and many others in the modern world, have attributed the tensions between the West and Islam to the Crusades. And they have portrayed the situation as if the Muslims were living their religion of peace and minding their own business and everything was fine. And then these racist colonialist invaders came from Europe, and that's the Crusades. That's not really what happened. What really happened was that there were 450 years of jihad attacks against the Christian world at the time. Half of the Christian world was conquered and Islamized, and what we think of today as the heart of the Islamic world, the Middle East and North Africa, that was all Christian territory, Christian areas. And it was these attacks and this Islamization was never opposed in any organized fashion by any Christian entity until the Crusades, and they were a late, small-scale defensive reaction to those 450 years of jihad. The Crusaders certainly did some things that we cannot excuse and do not attempt to, but the idea that they were some proto-colonialist misadventure is once more historical fiction.
So the basic truth at the heart of that way of understanding the Crusades is that the Muslim forces were, in at least in territorial terms, they were the aggressors here.
Yes. In the terms of the Crusades specifically, they were not the aggressors because the Crusaders did come and attack at a time when they were not being attacked. But the context of that is that in the year 1071, in Manzikert, eastern Turkey, the Byzantines, which was at that time the Christian Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, they suffered a disastrous defeat against the Seljuk Turks. and all of Asia Minor was lost to them. This was the heart, the breadbasket of the Byzantine Empire. And the Byzantine Emperor Alexius Comnenus, after that, appealed to the Pope for help and asked for military action that would help preserve the Christian Empire in the East and defend the pilgrims in the Holy Land who were being attacked and enslaved or even killed. And the Crusades were a somewhat delayed response to that. The First Crusade was called in 1095, 24 years later. It took some time to get things together and to decide to do it, because this was right at also the time of the great split between what became known as the Catholic and the Orthodox churches. So there was some reluctance, but nonetheless, it was ultimately overcome. And the Crusaders went as a response to the call of the Byzantine emperor. So in that sense, they were defending, although there is a bit of a time lapse in between.
Why do you think it is that so little of this history is known, Robert?
Todd, I think there's a deliberate effort to obfuscate it and to make sure that people don't know it, because they want us to accept various political positions of today. I mean, when Akbar Ahmed, who I mentioned earlier, that professor in Washington, says how wonderful Muslim Spain was, which is completely false on the historical level, he is trying to get Europeans today and Americans today to accept the idea of mass migration. And that mass migration into Europe, of course, is mostly Muslims. And so he wants the Europeans to think, oh, this will be wonderful. They established a great civilization once, and they'll do it again. Everything will be fine. And to be complacent about the threat. It's all politically motivated that history is being rewritten. And that's one of the primary reasons why I wrote The History of Jihad, to set the record straight, to make available to people the true history that is based on sources that were on the scenes at the time of that these things happened, not modern-day historians who are rewriting the record.
How do those historians explain that, at least in the 20th and 21st centuries, where Islam has political ascendancy, it does not produce great culture? It does great art. It may produce a lot of wealth through oil and things like that, but it doesn't produce the things that it is said to have produced culturally in history.
You've really hit the nail on the head with this question, because it's something that I've often pointed out when these silly museum expositions go out and or there are articles written touting them. Did you know that Muslims invented coffee and saxophones and crayons and, you know, every random thing? And then they really just actually end up doing the opposite of what they're intended to do. Instead of making people think, wow, isn't this wonderful? Isn't Islam a wonderful thing? They just lead to the question, well, why didn't they do anything with all this? If they invented all this, then how come it was left to the West to make anything of it? And that question, of course, remains unanswered. The real answer is because these innovations, for the most part, never really took place or were only incidental to the Islamic identity of the innovator. It wasn't that he was doing it because of Islam. He just happened to be a Muslim who discovered something.
And how do you answer that question, 30 seconds, that they have not done anything with whatever it was that did arise from their culture?
Islam actually discourages intellectual inquiry, discourages questioning, discourages reading books other than the Quran or approved Islamic literature. And consequently, this whole tradition of anti-intellectualism, which is as old as Islam itself, has inhibited innovation and free inquiry.
Robert Spencer is director of Jihad Watch. He's author of several books on Islam, including his latest, The History of Jihad, From Muhammad to ISIS. You can purchase The History of Jihad at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Robert, thank you very much for being our guest.
Always a pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
On the other side of the break, we're going to talk about an archaeological discovery that, although small, may be a very big deal indeed, a small ring with just one name inscribed on it, a name that students of the New Testament will find instantly familiar, that of Pilate. Dr. Craig Evans will be our guest. Please include the worldwide outreach of issues, etc. in your year-end giving. With 1 month left in 2018, we're $93,000 short of projected expenses. You can make a secure online gift at issuesetc.org. You can also make a year-end tax-deductible donation by check. Make your check payable to Issues, etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. This child, Jesus Christ, is the focus of every Christmas card that Emmanuel Press offers. Whether in stained glass, illumination, or classic works of art, Christmas cards from Emmanuel Press joyfully confess our Savior's birth with the words of Scripture and the poetry of hymns. Visit their website at emmanuelpress.us to create a custom assortment of cards. EmmanuelPress.us.